Well, go ahead and grab your Bibles if you have them and turn with me to Ecclesiastes. And we'll be in chapter 8 this morning. We've been making our way through this book together. And so if you've been with us for any length of time, you'll know that Solomon, the author here, has just been making some observations about life. And so he's just been sort of one by one walking throughout all these different areas of life that are, quite frankly, twisted. That is, those areas of life that not only seem to be backwards, but also just don't seem to make much sense to us. And so he's just been sort of talking about how there's supposed to be this order and even this rhythm to the universe, that there's just this natural design to things and even this flow and harmony to creation. But the reality is that all around us, no matter where you are or what the circumstance is that you're in, things seem to be broken. So, for instance, as you just sort of look out into the world, why is it that good things happen to what we would call bad people and bad things happen to what we would call good people? Or why in a world where there's so much motion and energy and even life, where everyone and everything is constantly trying to make progress and just sort of move things forward, but from the tiniest of insect to the greatest of planet, are we constantly surrounded by things in the consistent state of breakdown? Of things forever falling apart, of forever decomposing. There's just this backwardsness, this twistedness that doesn't seem to quite fit the natural order of what seems and even what feels to the human heart to be right. And so Solomon's spent nearly 8 chapters now just sort of observing everything that his eyes can see. And so he's just been labeling all of these areas of twistedness and all of the brokenness in life as futility. But what's interesting about last time is Solomon did something a little bit different. Just in his quest for wisdom and his quest to just sort of try and navigate through all of the mess, which he's been labeling here with the Hebrew term havel, for the first time in all of Ecclesiastes, he actually took a break from looking at the havel, which sort of exists outside of man, and showed how one of the greatest sources of havel, and actually one of the greatest reasons why so much of this world is twisted and fractured and broken, is because havel at its deepest levels, when you just sort of strip everything away, is something which actually resides within the human heart. And so while we live in a world which says that so much of what ails mankind and all of their hardships and all of their sufferings is the result of some external forces, Solomon showed that the greatest source of our ailments and the greatest cause of our issues isn't something merely external to us, but is actually something which resides in our own twisted, fractured hearts. And so for the first time in all of Ecclesiastes, Solomon addressed the greatest plague of mankind, which is sin. And this is something that we know and saw runs all throughout the scriptures. We saw that this really isn't just something Solomon decided to make up, but is actually something which the Bible as a whole declares to be true. It declares all mankind without exception to be broken. And so now with that, he sort of addressed that reality in chapter 7, it actually functions as a pretty good transition to what he's going to talk about in chapter 8, which is the nature of what happens when this sinful humanity comes together and actually tries to create systems of authority. That is, systems of hierarchy and even systems of government. And so what Solomon's going to do this morning, knowing that there is nothing we can actually do to fix the brokenness or actually fix the havel of those systems, is he's going to give us some wisdom for how to then navigate in and through the brokenness. In other words, he's simply going to give us some counsel for how to deal and then live in light of the reality of authority at whatever level in your life in a broken, fractured world. So let's go ahead and read it and then we'll jump in. It's chapter 8, and we're going to do the whole thing, verses 1 through 17. Solomon writes, "Who is like the wise man, and who knows the interpretation of a matter? A man's wisdom illumines him and causes his stern face to shine. I say, keep the command of the king because of the oath before God. And do not be in a hurry to leave him. Do not join in the evil matter, for he will do whatever he pleases. Since the word of the king is authoritative, who will say to him, what are you doing? He who keeps a royal command experiences no trouble, for a wise heart knows the proper time and procedure. For there is a proper time and procedure for every delight, though a man's trouble is heavy upon him. If no one knows what will happen, who can tell him when it will happen? No man has authority to restrain the wind with the wind or authority over the day of death, and there is no discharge in the time of war, and so evil will not deliver those who practice it. All this I have seen and applied my mind to every deed that's been done under the sun, wherein a man has exercised authority over another man to his hurt. So then I have seen the wicked buried, those who used to go in and out from the holy place. They are soon forgotten, better translated, praised, in the city where they did thus. This too is futility. Because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed quickly, therefore the hearts of the sons of men among them are given fully to do evil. Although a sinner does evil 100 times and may lengthen his life, still I know that it will be well for those who fear God and who fear him openly. But it will not be well for the evil man, and he will not lengthen his days like a shadow because he does not fear God. There is futility which is done on the earth, that is, there are righteous men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked. And on the other hand, there are evil men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. I say this too is havel. So I commended pleasure. For there is nothing good for a man under the sun except to eat and to drink and to be merry. And this will stand by him in his toils throughout the days of his life which God has given him under the sun. When I gave my heart to know wisdom and to see the task which has been done on the earth, even though one should never sleep day or night, and I saw every work of God, I concluded that man cannot discover the work which has been done under the sun. Even though man should seek laboriously, he will not discover, and though the wise man should say, I know, he cannot discover. Well, he begins here in verse 1 with this almost random statement. And the reason it seems random, if you were to just sort of read through the section, is that it actually functions as a kind of transition between what he said in chapter 7 and what he's going to talk about now in chapter 8. And so the point of the verse is actually to give us a general statement on the nature, but really the value of wisdom, which is what Solomon's all about. And so notice he actually poses it in the form of a question. And his reason for doing that is actually to draw attention to the fact that a wise person is actually an incredibly rare thing. And so the reality for Solomon is that in a world crippled by havel and filled with broken, sinful humanity, he observes here that wisdom and the actual exercise of wisdom is incredibly unique. And so Solomon, just being the kind of person that he is, begins here by actually challenging the assumption in everybody's mind that they are then somehow the exception to the rarity. That they actually are a wise person and that they do operate and make decisions from a position of wisdom. Because look at what he goes on to say. He states it's a wise person whose wisdom actually illumines them and then causes their face to shine. In other words, the imagery here is that there's a sense in which a person's wisdom, if it's a true wisdom, will actually affect their life. And so they're not just a talker, they're not just one who assents to certain ideas, but they're actually a person who believes what they say and then lives in light of what they say. And so the imagery here of a man's wisdom illumining him is actually a reference to the fact that wisdom has this way of producing a kind of calmness, but actually a real sense of assurance in the midst of the many unknowns in life. In other words, we're a fool, or in the context of Ecclesiastes, simply a person who isn't entrusting their life to the providence of God might become incredibly anxious because of the unknown. A wise person, as a result of their wisdom, knows a kind of peace in the midst of the unknown. And so Solomon's just saying here that there's just a kind of light and, in fact, a kind of sobriety that wisdom will actually produce in a person. Notice also this idea of illumination. This is actually a common Old Testament reference to where in the midst of great difficulty, or even just in the midst of an unknown circumstance, you actually see this idea of light or shining being used to speak of a kind of joy. That there's just a kind of countenance or a kind of posture that wisdom will bring to a person when they don't actually know all the answers or know what's to come in life. The reality is that both the wise and the fool alike experience many unknowns and many frustrations in life, but it's the presence of wisdom and the true exercise of wisdom that'll actually sustain a person and even produce a kind of joy. And so Solomon here just begins by giving this general statement on the value of wisdom, but also the real-life evidence of wisdom in a person's life, which in all reality, and according to Solomon here, is actually an incredibly rare thing, especially when it comes to his topic here regarding the nature of government, or more broadly, authority. So look at what he says here, starting in verse 2. He writes, "I say, keep the command of the king because of the oath before God. Do not be in a hurry to leave him, and do not join in an evil matter." Why? "For he," that is the king, "will do whatever he pleases." So he begins here by giving this simple, yet oftentimes difficult command to follow, which of course is to submit to and obey the king. And what's interesting here is he actually gives a few reasons for why this is a good thing. And so notice his first reason is actually a matter of principle, and therefore the one that should more or less govern all the others. He states, keep the command of the king. Why? Because of the oath before God. Now, as you know, within the context of Israel, the king was actually someone established by God himself. And so the king would actually represent a kind of oath or actually a kind of covenant between God and his people. And so the reality then is that to disobey the king would actually be nothing less than to disobey the one who put him there, which of course would be God himself. And so Solomon here begins with nothing less than a motivation for obedience. And if you're understanding it rightly, it's actually a motivation that has very little to do with pragmatics. In other words, it has very little to do with things like policy or how well the king rules, or even with what kind of fairness or equity he exercises when dealing with his people. Rather, Solomon's reason here has everything to do with how and why the king's been put there in the first place. And so the real weight of what's behind Solomon's command here is that obedience to rulers has actually more to do with worship than we might think. Now, Paul himself actually picks this concept up in the New Testament in Romans chapter 13, where just coming off a section there on what it looks like to present your body as a living sacrifice that's actually acceptable to God. He says there in chapter 13 that a mark of anyone who's pleasing to God, that is anyone who God himself actually delights in, is one who's in subjection to their governing authorities. And then he goes on to give the reason. He states the reason that submission is worship is because there is no authority except from God, and those which exist have been established by God. And so in Paul's mind, just like Solomon, to disobey the governing authorities is actually nothing less than to disobey God himself. We see this also in 1 Peter chapter 2, where Peter states, as sojourners and strangers, that is, as those who don't actually belong to this world or have their citizenship in this world, he says, submit yourself for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as one in authority or to a governor as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. And so his point there is that whatever the time, whatever the circumstance, whatever the hardship, whether you live under a king who rules for his own pleasure Or in the case of Paul and Peter, a wicked, even twisted emperor, or even in our case, a president in a democracy who promotes utterly anti-biblical agendas. The point is that Christians are never to be known, regardless of circumstances, as insurrectionists. The reality is that God is the one who's put these authorities into place, and he's put them there to rule. And so Solomon just begins here by saying your motivation for obeying these authorities isn't because they protect Christians and want to promote your rights, or even because they have your best interests in mind, but simply because God, from his will and from his good pleasure, has established them into power. And that's the principle. But then notice what he says. He actually expands the command here by saying this. He says, do not be in a hurry to leave him, that is the king, and do not join in an evil matter. In other words, as one man states, this is nothing more than a warning against things like rebellion, conspiracy, and revolution. And so he's just saying here that the mark of a fool is anyone who walks into the throne room for the purpose of proclaiming their loyalty and allegiance and then just turns around and sort of stages a coup. A wise person is not only one who recognizes that God has placed the king into power, but at a much more practical level, just recognizes the fact that the king actually possesses power. And so the idea of a king here doing whatever he pleases is actually connected here with verse 4, where the king is described as having the ultimate authority and final say. And so the point then is that no matter what a person desires or even what a person tries to do, the reality is that the king has not only the authority, but also the ability to actually crush all activity which opposes him. And so what Solomon's saying, as one who well knew what it meant to wield judicial power, is that no matter the severity or the unjust treatment of the punishment, the reality is there's no one who can actually say or do anything about it. There was no such thing as constitutionally protected free speech in Israel. And so Solomon was a king. He was established by God, and his meaning here is that in this life, God has given all the governing authorities an enormous amount of power. And so here's the point I just want to sort of try and draw out from this. In the context of Ecclesiastes, Solomon's constantly speaking with reference to the reality of a broken, twisted world, right? And so all that he's getting at here is that while he's certainly not condoning the actions of ruling authorities who might rule or even judge with unrighteousness, his point is that regardless of the amount of injustice or even the harsh treatment that might come from those in authority, the reality is they still possess an enormous amount of authority, and it's a reality which comes from God. And so here's the point. No matter where you are in this life, the reality is that you submit to somebody. If you're an employee, it's your boss. If you're a child, it's your parents. If you're a wife in a biblical marriage, it's your husband. But here's sort of the point. Every single one of those ruling authorities at some level or another, regardless of even Christian maturity, is sinful, broken, and at the end of the day, to some degree, unjust. And so the meaning of Solomon is that no amount of injustice, brokenness, or even twistedness will actually remove or ever make void the reality of that authority in your life. Now, you can quit your job, or you can run away from home, or you can even divorce your spouse, but none of those things actually deny the fact that God has still put them there and that he's put them there with some level of authority. And furthermore, no matter how far you run or even how many things you try to change, the truth of the matter is there's always going to be somebody higher. And so if you quit your job, you're still going to have to find another employer. And if you leave this country, you're still going to have to live under the authority of another country. And so no matter where you go in this life, there will always be authority. And to one degree or another, it'll always be broken. That's his point. And so really the first point of Solomon here is simply to say, learn to recognize that authority is a reality, but it's a reality that exists in a broken, fractured world. The implication here is that every single authoritative reality in your life at some point or another will fail you. But none of those failures will ever nullify the fact that God has still established them there. And in some cases, they come with enormous power. And so Solomon just says here that it is the wise person who can actually recognize this truth and then order their life in light of this truth. Now, he's going to go on to give us some wisdom for how to navigate this sort of thing. And so that's actually what he gets into here, starting in verse 5. So notice what he says. He states verses 5 and 6. He who keeps a royal command experiences no trouble, for a wise heart knows the proper time and procedure. For there is a proper time and procedure for every delight, though a man's trouble is heavy upon him. So he just got done saying that God's put certain authorities into place, and he's actually put them there with an actual ability to exercise that authority. And so the point here is that if that's true, and since that's the case, then generally speaking, the way to live a peaceful life and the way to live in a manner that experiences less trouble is to then actually order your life in accordance to what the law demands. In other words, if you don't like what some authority over you is doing, or you don't like a certain cause that your taxes are funding, and so you decide to create some kind of uprising, or even something as passive as not paying your taxes, then don't be surprised when trouble comes for you. Or worse, think you're some kind of martyr. And so notice what he does here. This term for trouble or harm is actually the Hebrew word for evil. And so it could be translated as, he who keeps a royal command experiences no evil. In other words, you could do something unjust and therefore incite the wrath of the authorities. But the reality is that since authoritative structures are often made up of unjust people, even the punishment which you should receive for your unjust action could in and of itself be unjust. Which is why he calls it evil. That's the twisted thing. And so while that seems so incredibly backwards, notice Solomon nowhere states that you should then try and do something about the unjust treatment. Rather, the emphasis here is completely on you as the unjust individual. And so the point is that if you don't want to experience that kind of evil, and if you don't want to have that kind of trouble come into your life, then the command of Solomon is simply to be a person who obeys the laws of the land. Or your workplace. And then notice, he goes on to give some wisdom for how to navigate through this reality. So nowhere in the passage does he say we should just keep quiet and never actually acknowledge or speak about the unjust authorities, but he does say here that there's just a right way to go about it. And so notice, he says there's a proper time and procedure to approach these things. In other words, there's just a way to address these things and actually speak about these things that won't actually incite the wrath of the authorities. There's just a manner and even method built into the very structure of most institutions that makes your words and your cause appropriate as opposed to wrath invoking. But here's the catch in all of this. Notice what he says. He states it's the wise man, or actually the wise heart, who recognizes this truth and then actually lives in accordance to this truth. The fact that he uses the term heart here as opposed to just merely man or woman is because he's trying to imply something about that which actually controls a person. The heart, as you know, in Hebrew thought was a term they used in reference to sort of the center of a person. To that which motivates a person and actually controls a person. That it's from out of the heart that a person acts and speaks and makes their decisions. And so what Solomon's getting at by using the term heart is that when it comes to unjust realities and those wrongful, wicked things, especially when those things are committed against you, is that it doesn't take very long for your inner being to just sort of boil up, does it? And to be honest, there's actually nothing wrong with that. It's actually what theologians refer to as your judicial sentiment. That because the law of God has been placed on every person's heart, there's just this natural instinct and this natural reaction to when an injustice is committed either against you or even another person, you can't help but to feel sort of the wickedness of that action. But the problem is, because we are still sinners and because we are so prone to want to rise to our own sort of self-defense, the reality is that more often than not, instead of reacting in a righteous manner, and instead of addressing the wrong in a rightful way, even though we do know what's right to do, we just end up lashing out in unrighteousness. And that's because we're reacting wickedly from the heart. And so the point of Solomon here is not so much to give instruction on what to do, because the truth of the matter, more often than not, is we know what the right thing to do is. We do know what the proper procedure is, but rather it's to draw attention to the heart. That is to draw attention to the fact that it's your heart which needs to be guided by wisdom. Rarely is a person fired because they didn't know the procedure for confronting the unjust actions of the boss, right? Rather, it's usually due to an inappropriate exchange of words or an attempt to undermine that boss, isn't it? Protesters don't get arrested because they don't know violence makes their demonstrations unconstitutional. But rather, it's because when what they view to be an injustice meets the passions of their own unwise hearts, they begin to suppress the knowledge of that proper procedure for making that injustice unknown. And somehow actually begin to justify their own injustices. It is amazing how many people think that because an injustice has been committed against them, or as he says here in verse 6, there's a trouble that weighs heavy on a person, that then an unjust response is somehow appropriate or even warranted or even necessary. And so the point of Solomon here is that no matter who you are, what situation you're in, the reality is that you have an authority over you. And because you live in a broken, fallen world, chances are that some level or another that authority is corrupt. Or at the very least, times in which they act unjust. And so his counsel to us here is that no matter what the corruption or what the injustice, there's just a way to address those things in a manner that's appropriate. That is, in a manner that doesn't incite the wrath of that authority. And so it is the wise person who knows that there's just a way for a child to appeal their parents or for a wife to appeal their husband or a worker, their boss, that won't bring a kind of reality that makes the unwise action or that instinctual response from the heart that's usually just anger totally not even worth it. And so Solomon just says there's simply a time and a procedure for everything. And God has so ordered it to be. But then Solomon being Solomon actually caveats that truth with this statement. Look at what he says here in verse 7. He writes, "If no one knows what will happen, then who can tell him when it will happen?" So he just says here, look, there's a time and there's a procedure and there's just a way to go about dealing with the injustices of those authorities over you. But the reality of this life and the reality of living in a broken, fallen world is that sometimes you can do everything right. Like sometimes you can say everything in a respectful way, or you can follow all of the procedures and fill out all the right paperwork. But at the end of the day, the reality of life under the sun is that sometimes you still just don't know what's going to happen. In fact, sometimes doing the right thing and waiting for the right time and seeking out the righteous resolution might just end up creating a worse problem than had you just done nothing in the first place. And so the point of Solomon is that no amount of acting in a just, right manner actually guarantees that justice will ever prevail. The reality is that no one, not even the wisest person, actually knows the outcome of their situation. And so the nature of living in a Havel-ridden world where so much is backwards and so much is bent and so much is so incredibly broken is that there's no formula that'll actually guarantee righteousness. And so the reality is that sometimes doing the right thing and following all of the protocol could just end up making your situation worse. And so the meaning of Solomon here is that every time you see an injustice and every time you see a wickedness or experience a wrong committed against you, it's the wise person who knows that there's a proper time and procedure for addressing those things, but just never forget that there is no guarantee that it'll actually end in your favor. And so it's the wise person who's not actually surprised by this reality. And so Solomon here, knowing that this kind of experience and this kind of reality actually has this way of just frustrating a person, and oftentimes rightfully so, he knows well the temptation for a person to just sort of lose it. You ever been there? Like when you do everything right and you follow the grievance policy or you respond in a kind, humble, respectful manner and it still just goes bad for you. The natural response of anyone, because of that judicial sentiment, is just to get angry, isn't it? It's to just take matters into your own hands, to just try and make your own justice or settle your own accounts. So look what he says about that here in verse 8. He says, in the midst of feeling that way, and in the midst of thinking you're actually going to be able to straighten what authority seems so content to just leave crooked, here's the reality. The reality is that no man actually has authority to restrain the wind with the wind or authority over the day of death, and there is no discharge in the time of war, and so evil will not deliver those who practice it. And so all he's saying here is that in the midst of that moment, like in the midst of feeling that temptation, when you start buying into the lie that it's actually your job to make the wrong right, or it's actually your duty and even right to straighten what's gone so crooked, that responding to evil with evil, because that's exactly what you're doing. The reality is you're not the authority. You're not the one established by God to make this right. And so to act out would be an act of evil. The point of Solomon is simply to say, just never forget that it'll never actually deliver as promised. In fact, you can almost guarantee that the unjust authority will all of a sudden become incredibly just in their dealings with you. It doesn't matter if it's in the home or the workplace or the province. The reality is that all authority has been established by God. And so when you go rogue, that is when you step outside the bounds or what he calls here the procedures, according to Solomon, you do nothing more than commit an act of evil. And it's a kind of evil, as he says here, that'll never actually deliver or bring about what you hope. And so just like you have no ability to control the wind or the day of your death or even something like discharge in the midst of a battle, the reality is we have no ability to bring true justice. And so to try and seek it out through unestablished means is to do nothing more than add to the list of injustices which God himself always sees and will bring to account. And so the point of the verse is that justice is never truly just unless it's been carried out by God's established means. And often, if we're honest, we're almost never that established means. Which is why, regardless of the sort of pragmatic good that they might bring about, things like uprising and revolts and revolutions are always folly. They are, in the first instance, always an act of injustice. And so Solomon just says, be wise. That is, know your place and understand the nature of true justice. Next, verses 9 and 10. He writes, All this I have seen and applied my mind to every deed that's been done under the sun, wherein a man has exercised authority over another man to his hurt. So then I have seen the wicked buried, and those who used to go in and out from the holy place, they are praised in the city where they did thus. This too is futility. So he begins here by just taking a step back and sort of taking stock of everything he's said so far. And he begins here by saying that I have observed all of these realities. And not only have I observed them, but I've actually thought about them. That is, I've applied my mind to know them and to understand them, and specifically those areas where authority exists. And as I make my observations and I see all that's being done, the constant thing I see over and over again is that the ones who are in power simply use their power for the sake of personal gain, and almost always on the backs of those below them. And so he just says, this is what I see, and it's backwards. He says, that's the twisted thing. That's the Havel. You see it in government. You see it in the workplace. You even see it in the home. There's just an injustice in this world. And so Solomon says, wherever there's human authority, there's humans exploiting humans. And not only is there exploitation and harm being done to those in sort of a weaker position, but he goes on to say here that at the end of the day, all of the sort of great ones in society, that is, all the ones who've achieved big things and have amassed wealth and respect and almost always at the cost of others, are always and forever praised for their accomplishments. And so notice what he says here in verse 10. He describes these wicked ones who are being buried as those who actually used to go in and out of the holy place, that is, the temple. And so really all that Solomon's doing here is giving nothing more than a picture of hypocrisy. That is, of looking a certain way to society all the while they just sort of sit up in their office and make their decisions behind a closed door. And then when they're done balancing all of their bank accounts, they take all of their wealth and all of their money and all of their power and head down to the church so that they can light their candles. And there they'll read their Bibles and donate large amounts of money and get their names inscribed in all of the buildings that they donate. And then at the end of the day, when all is said and done, no one ever actually sees the wickedness. No one ever actually asks who had to suffer or who had to be harmed so that this person could just keep getting wealthier and instead only see their achievements. And so in the final analysis of this person's life, Solomon says, even in death, the city just praises them. But beyond that, notice what he says here in verse 11. He says, because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed quickly, therefore the hearts of the sons of men among them are given fully to do evil. In other words, there are times in which the evil does become known, doesn't it? Like the media actually gets behind the closed door, or the recording does get published to Facebook. But the problem is that the slowness of the justice, maybe even due to the fact that there's corruption in the Justice Department, the slowness of justice and the lack of urgency in the process actually becomes a motivator for these people to just do more evil. In fact, notice their hearts are given fully to do evil. There is a real sense in which the slowness of justice or lack of urgency for justice actually fosters a kind of environment in which those who have been getting away with their evil simply plow themselves all the more into it. And so while I'm sure that there's an enormous amount of implications for this truth all over our society, especially within the Justice Department, as I thought about this, let me just sort of say by way of implication to every parent in this room on the authority of this passage. Do not assume that your slowness to discipline, or maybe your desire to show some kind of grace, is somehow beneficial to the true nature of the kind of heart your child actually possesses. In the moment of their evil, because that's exactly what it is, the means of grace established by God for your home and for your child is the discipline. The scriptures cannot be clearer that God has established every level of authority in this world, and so when it comes to your home, you're the authority. The reality is you've been placed there by God's providence and for God's purposes. And so one of the main reasons behind God's establishment of all authority is the upholding of justice. And every sin is an injustice against God. And so to be slow to bring that about or slow to address the sin, even if you think you're showing grace, is nothing more, according to Solomon, than to give room for the heart to be given fully to evil. At some point, especially within the home, I think our laziness or our fear of not being loved and the assumption that what we model, that is the way we speak and the way we live and the way we make decisions, will simply be followed by those in the home, often whether we want to acknowledge it or not, simply encourage negligence. We make room and allow for the heart of a person to bloom into the fullness of what it truly is, which, as we saw last time, is nothing less than idolatry and sin. And so my point here is not necessarily to make comment on the kind of parenting style you choose. Don't hear it that way. But it is for you to take passages like these into consideration when deciding what to do with the injustice and sin in your home, or what you think discipline should look like, or how swift you carry out that God-given duty. Do not assume that kindness or slowness or passivity or turning a blind eye within your home is ever a good thing for the hearts of the ones who've been entrusted to you. God has designed this world in such a way, and so according to Solomon, an apathy or slowness toward justice simply treads against the grain that he's established. And here's why we should take passages like these serious. Look what he says here in verses 12 through 13. He states, "Although a sinner does evil 100 times and may lengthen his life, still I know that it will be well for those who fear God and who fear him openly. But it will not be well for the evil man, and he will not lengthen his days like a shadow or find in them a kind of protection. Why? Because the reality is that he does not fear God." There is a point in which when a person gets away with something long enough, especially in a world where things are backwards, and especially in a world where, as he says in the next verses, the righteous are often suppressed and the unrighteous are often exalted, in a world where good things come to the evil and evil comes to the upright, in a world where the wicked often live long and grow wealthy and prosperous, all the while those who fear the Lord and love the gospel and seek to walk in holiness are often persecuted, oppressed, and even martyred. It's in a world like that, which is a world that Solomon's observing all throughout this book, where the lack of justice and the lack of discipline and the lack of any kind of righteous mandate comes to bear on a person's wickedness, where they begin to believe the lie that they're actually safe, that they've actually somehow escaped justice, that they've somehow actually avoided the what should be natural and righteous order of God's creation. But the point of Solomon, and as Paul himself goes on to state in Romans chapter 2, that the longer a person lives, and the more evil they're able to accomplish, and the longer that they go about gaining pleasure from the wickedness of their own deeds, all they're actually doing is nothing more than storing up for themselves wrath upon wrath upon wrath for what the scriptures call the day of wrath. And so while we live in an age in which so many people are happy that we're all living longer and healthier and wealthier, the truth of the scriptures is that that should be an absolutely frightening reality for the unbeliever. And if you're one who right now is saying that you don't oppress people, that you're not one who extorts the weak or goes about looking for ways to get rich off the backs of the poor. In other words, that you're not a person who's just sort of given to what Solomon's calling evil. The interesting thing about Paul's passage is that just one chapter earlier, he explains why the wrath of God is actually coming. And he says there in chapter 1 in verse 18 that the wrath of God comes not because you go about suppressing people, but because you're one who's in the consistent state of suppressing the truth. And the way that that suppressing of the truth works itself out according to that passage is by being one who simply does not honor God as God or gives him thanks. Or what Solomon simply calls here in this passage, fear. See, the wrath of God, as the scriptures know it, that is that judicial act by which God will issue out his perfect justice and set all accounts right, is a kind of disposition which he has, not in the first instance against the most heinous of sinners, but against the evil, wicked sinfulness of indifference. Against the sin of thinking that you can just go about your day breathing his air and eating his food and wearing his clothes and interacting with his creation, all the while refusing to give a single thought, or perhaps even worse, just a bored thought, and think that everything will just somehow work out for you before the throne. Solomon says that's the essence of folly. The reality is that everything we have and are nothing but gifts of divine grace that he's been giving and sustaining day after day after day. But the ultimate reality and the ultimate conclusion is that a day is coming, regardless of how many years God's good to give to you, in which there won't be a tomorrow. How many are living their lives day after day assuming tomorrow is actually going to be there? Or perhaps worse, assuming that tomorrow will be the day in which they finally take the things of God serious. And so Solomon's just trying to say, be wise. That is, be one who fears him. Be one who, as it says here, fears him openly, quite literally, as one who's before his face. That is, one who's aware of his judgments and that he knows and sees and brings all things to account. In other words, be one who's aware that tomorrow's not actually promised. Be one who understands yourself to be right now a sinner who stands in judgment. Understand that you, by your very nature, are opposed to the very ordinances of God. And if you debate that, then as one who's simply dismissing God as God or just ignoring him, be one who knows that to live in a state of indifference is to live in a state of rebellion. There is no neutrality. There is no safe place. That every day you just go about your life giving not much thought to the one who gives you those days is to be a person storing up infinite wrath of an infinite God who judges in perfect justice and without partiality. And so Solomon is just saying here, for our good, do not be such a fool. It will not be, as he says here, well for you. The distractions and the pleasures of everyday life are no indication of the gravity of what's to come. And so Solomon says, do not ignore him. Do not persist in your evil, for all that awaits those who stand outside of Christ is judgment. So look at what he does next. He makes yet one more time this observation in verse 14 that there's just this twistedness and this brokenness to all of life, especially in the areas of justice and righteousness. And so notice what he says in verse 15. He states, after all of this, I commended pleasure. For there is nothing good for a man under the sun to eat and to drink and to be merry. And this will stand by him in all of his toils throughout the days of his life, which God has given him under the sun. So it's kind of a strange sounding conclusion, and mostly because it's sort of difficult to connect it with what he's been saying so far in this passage. But what makes it easy to interpret is that he's actually concluded this way two other times in the book before this. You'll remember in chapter 2, verses 24 through 26, and chapter 3, verse 22. And so in both of those cases, he had actually just finished talking about some area of havel or futile aspect of life in which a person actually has no ability to sort of solve the havel. And so what Solomon's saying here is that in the midst of the twistedness and in the midst of life's greatest difficulties, or in the context here, in the midst of life's greatest injustices, especially the ones that have been committed against you, the point of Solomon here is that there's literally nothing better for you than to refuse to find your hope, joy, peace, and happiness in the wrongs being made right. Probably because, as he hints in verses 16 and 17, it's not actually going to happen, at least to any kind of satisfaction. But rather to find your joy, contentment, and satisfaction in the details and the gifts of life. And that's his counsel. A believer's food, even in the midst of great difficulty and great oppression and immense hardship, should just taste better than the unbeliever's. Your sleep should be sounder. Your joy should be fuller, because the reality, if you're living by faith, is that you have a knowledge of what's to come. You have an intimate awareness that God sees all things and that nothing actually goes unnoticed. That every injustice, whether it be personal, national, or global, whether it be past, present, or future, it'll be dealt with, and it'll be dealt with in full. And so the point of Solomon with this strange and yet at the same time at this point in the book expected conclusion is this. He says, seek justice, but seek it in the times and procedures that have been allotted to you, and then go home and sit down to your dinner. And regardless if it's an issue in the state or at your job or between friends or even within the home, know that whether justice prevails now or later, it's going to prevail. And if it's something that won't be dealt with until it's before the throne of the Creator, never forget that God's justice is incredibly full, it's absolutely perfect, and it's undeniably holy. And so his justice will forever reign supreme. So here's my final warning to us this morning. And it is a warning. Since, as I just mentioned, God is just, perfect, and holy, the reality is so are his judgments. And so if you're an unbeliever in here this morning, or you're just someone who, while you don't actively reject God, you're just sort of indifferent toward him, the truth of the scriptures is all that awaits you, whether you choose to believe it or not, is judgment. And so the problem with living in our society is that everything is just sort of easy, isn't it? Like, we don't experience much hardship, and we don't experience much relative pain to the rest of the world. And so it's easy to just sort of coast, to just go about life sort of hopping from one activity to another, giving not much thought to the creator and sustainer of your life. And so the call of this passage and the call of the scriptures is to turn from that kind of living. To turn from a sort of indifferent, or maybe it is a hostile attitude, and recognize that to store up wrath for the day of wrath before the eyes of a holy, perfect, impartial judge will not, as Solomon said here, end well for you. And to instead turn toward the one, that is the person of Christ, who in his death on the cross has taken on the fullness of that infinite wrath for you. That all of your injustice, all of your wrongs, all of your sin, past, present, and future, has been dealt with, and it's been dealt with in full and forever settled in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And all of us, whether you're a believer or unbeliever, live under authority. And that ultimate authority is not government. It is not your boss. It is not your husband. But it is and will forever be the perfect judge and creator himself. One with whom there is no fault and with whom there is no corruption or brokenness. And one day, we're going to stand before him. All of us. And it'll be on that day in which you can stand before him alone, condemned and guilty in your sin. Or you can stand before him and right next to you, mediating, will be the person of Christ. So that when God sees you, the only thing he sees in that moment is the perfection of his Son. His Son who is without spot, without blemish, and who is forever keeping you secure in him. And then as Psalm 73, one of my favorites, so powerfully portrays, he'll then lay hold of you by your right hand. He'll wipe away all of your tears. And at that moment, as the writer says, he'll then receive you into his everlasting glory. The kind of glory where there is no pain, there is no brokenness, and ultimately, where there's no more avail. And so that's the call of the scriptures, and that's my hope and my prayer for us this morning.